Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 265, and we're going to talk about why your rig is the best rig, and you shouldn't listen to what anybody else says about it, even me. We're also going to talk about what to do if you find a wet spot in your van, and you might not like what I'm going to say. A product review of sneakers, and a tale from the road involving dogs and sharks, because that's fun. Hello, everyone. I am back. Well, I'm back. I mean, where did I go? I'm back in Chicago. Temporarily. I just looked at my calendar and I realized I'm not going to be here very long, but I am back in Chicago after several weeks of epic travel, and it's time to get to work. I've got this truck camper. I need to get onto a truck and then hit the road, and that is my plan, although I may run out of time, and if I do, that is okay, because it's been a really busy summer, and there's been so much going on. So I am not going to beat myself up over it, but that is my plan. I have the truck camper. It is waiting for me to make it not mushy. Okay, time. Just a little diversion here. The truck camper has a leak. Now, this is a travel light truck camper. They are well known for their leaks. I was told the leaks were fixed. I did not believe it. I knew there were leaks, and that's why I talked the guy down in price to basically half of what the thing's worth, because it has some fairly serious leaks. I didn't realize how serious, though. On a truck camper, the parts that are on the side, like the floor on the side, not where you would stand, but where you would sit, the part that overhangs the side of the truck, those are called wings. And my wings are completely rotten. I was able to stick my finger completely through one of the wings to the outside. So they need to be replaced. So I have to do that. Now, like I said, I got this thing for about half the price that it should have sold for. I'm not too broken up about it, but it's a lot of work. I basically have to take those off, reroute all the gas lines, and figure out how the furnace is attached to it, and then somehow move all that stuff out of the way, put up new, solid, somewhat waterproof wood, and then be done with it. But before that, I got to figure out where the leak is. And the roof is solid. It's a big solid piece rubber membrane. I don't see any chance of a leak there. Where the fiberglass cap meets the roof, somebody went absolutely hog wild with DyCor. There's probably $50 worth of DyCor up there, but it looks okay. I mean, it's way too much, but I don't see how water could get in there, so I don't think that's where it is. No, I think it's the windows. This is a strange truck camper, and the windows are not the ones that come with it. There were custom windows, and I think they didn't use any butyl tape in the windows. I think they just used this foam, which is not as good. Pro tip, if you are installing windows in your van, do not trust the foam. Absolutely use butyl tape. That's the stuff that's going to save you. So I have to either take the windows out and redo that, or I don't know what I'm going to do. But anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about that in Tech Talk, but that's where I am in my van life journey. Now, in talking about my van life journey has, of course, let you guys hear about all my struggles with my Sprinter. And I have come up with this little bit of a catchphrase where I say, never buy a Sprinter, never buy a diesel Sprinter, never buy a diesel Sprinter ambulance, which is, of course, what I bought. Now, I got a letter, a very thoughtful letter from a listener named Jess, and I'm going to read a bit of it to you in regards to my basically bad-mouthing Sprinters. And it says, I just listened to episode 260 and RIP to your van. Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. I know you've had a difficult time with Sprinters in your life, but I just wanted to let you know that it isn't like that for everyone. I know you value data over anecdotes, and I'm surprised that you harbor such a deep hatred for Sprinters based on your experience alone. An assumption. I am happy to say that my husband and I have been traveling full-time for the last 2.5 years in our Sprinter with hardly any problems, knock on wood. On the internet, people only share their horror stories and not all the days where nothing goes wrong. So the internet would have you believe that Sprinters are just by nature an absolute nightmare to deal with. I hope you can see that it's just not true in all cases. To be fair, we drive our rig almost every day and bought it brand new. so we have a different use case than you. And she goes on to say about how they're planning to visit Saint-Pierre and Miquelon up in the north of Canada, but it's actually France, and I think that's very cool. And anyway, super nice letter. Thank you, Jess. That was a really nice thing. And I absolutely appreciate when anybody wants to call me out on something. And this opens up a door for a good, good conversation. So, if you've been following along with all my trials and tribulations with my Sprinter, you may have come away with the opinion that Sprinters are completely to be avoided. This letter did not change my opinion on that, but there are definitely some things to talk about. First, not all Sprinters are the same. In the US, there have been basically three Sprinters. They were the T1N, which was the first Sprinter, the first Eurovan actually to come to the US. That was between 2001 and 2006. There was the NCV3, which stood for New Concept Van 3, which is what I had, and that was between 2007 and 2018. And then there was the VS30, which was 2019 to present. So if you went out and bought a brand new Sprinter today, you would get a VS30. Those are completely different vehicles, all three of them. I mean, yes, they're all Sprinters, but they're so different that you can think of them as completely different vehicles. The T1N was a legendary van with a bulletproof engine. It had a five-cylinder engine. It would turn off the fifth cylinder. It was a little bit strange. That van was amazing. Those engines would run forever. Its big flaw was rust and this thing called the Black Death. We don't have to get into that. But basically, those T1Ns were amazing. Unfortunately, the newest of them now is nearly 20 years old. And, you know, that's an issue. Then came the NCV3s, which were a whole brand new van that had very little in common with the T1Ns. That's what I had. But even they're broken down into different types. The ones that came out in 2008 were radically different from the one I had from 2011 because of changes in the laws regarding diesel exhaust fluid. My 2011 was one of the earlier ones that had all that stuff. And if you were to go back and listen to all my litany of woes, a lot of them were from that. They had to find a way to fit a big tank in there, and that didn't work very well. And the thing right now that actually has killed the van is these swirl valves, which are part of that system. But anyway, so you can think of the NCV3s as two different ones, actually. And actually three, because there was the pre-def, the early def, and the late def. And the late def certainly performed better. And then there is the VS30, which is the current ones, which is all brand new and completely different and really doesn't have very much in common at all. Now, when I'm talking about Sprinters, I, of course, am talking mostly about the NCV3, and I got the worst Sprinter possible. Out of all the Sprinters I've listed, the first generation of DEF-equipped Sprinters, Blue Tech, I believe is what they were called, were the worst. They had the most problems. But that is not my main complaint about Sprinters. Jess is right. I don't care what you're driving. If you Google it or go on Facebook or whatever, and I belong to all the Facebook groups for all the vans. I follow along. Even though I've never owned some of these vans, I follow along to see what the problems are so I can stay informed. And what you see is an endless litany of these vans are junk. I've never had a worse van in my life. And it doesn't matter what kind of van you have. For the Ford Transits, which arguably have the least complaining, to be honest, their brakes are a nightmare. I don't know what the deal is with the brakes, but apparently they're a huge problem to change. They go bad often, and they're expensive. With the ProMasters, it seems to be the transmission most people are worried about. Several people have had catastrophic transmission failures in the 50,000 to 60,000 mile range, somewhere under 100,000, which is obviously a pretty big deal. And they also have to deal with the Pentastar tick, which is a thing notable for the engines that are in the ProMasters. I'm going to skip the Chevy vans for now because they're just old. In fact, I just drove a Chevy van this weekend, and holy cow, this 2025 van was like going back in time driving this thing. I felt like it was 1992 again. Anyway, we'll put those aside. And then there's the Sprinters. Now, Sprinters are amazing vans, and I have said many times that I love this van. When it's running, it is a great van. It's comfortable. The viewing area is amazing. Yeah, it's got some quirks I don't like. The gauges on the dashboard that kind of don't exist. I'm not a fan of that. any van or any vehicle even without a temperature gauge is deficient, in my opinion. And the ridiculous locking system where you never know if the doors are locked or not, yeah, that bugs me. But to Jess's point, and she does say this, her use case is different. If you went out right now and bought a brand new Sprinter with a warranty, you are going to have a lovely experience in probably the most refined van that you can get. I freely admit that. My complaint about the Sprinter and why I think you should avoid it over the other vans is that you can't fix it. Unless you are a mechanic yourself, or you happen to be lucky enough to be in an area where there is a mechanic who can work on it and they're reliable, you're going to find yourself eventually stuck or very, very poor. Sprinters are by far the most expensive vans to maintain. You can look up any source you would like and you will see that. But worse than that, let's say you're willing to spend the money, as I have been, you can't find anyone to work on it, and that's especially true for the older Sprinters such as mine. And in my case, in trying to deal with that problem, I found somebody local who had a Sprinter and who worked on them. And they may have contributed to my problem now, because if you remember, I said the belt fell off of the van when it wasn't moving. I don't know how that's possible. It was a brand new belt that I had just put on in the fall. It had like 10 miles on it. And that's an exaggeration. It was probably fewer than 10. I think the guy screwed up when he put the belt on, and he replaced all the pulleys too. So I think the belts and the pulleys are incorrect. The problem is, and this illustrates exactly the problem with Sprinters. Let's say that I wanted to try to repair the van. All I really have to do is get that belt back on it, and then I can be in limp mode and drive somewhere. To get that belt back on, I have to find someone who's willing to work on it, and I can't. The closest place that is willing to work on it, and this is with like a 2-week wait, is the Mercedes dealer in Chicago who has been working on it most of the time. And I have to get it there, and it's 100 miles away, and it's not drivable. Now, I could probably use AAA to tow it all the way up there, which would be a major pain in the butt, because they have to drop the drive shaft to tow this thing. Or, I don't know. But that's what my problem is with Sprinters. If I had a Transit or a ProMaster, it wouldn't be that hard, especially if it was a gasoline engine. I'm finding it just difficult to find anyone who'll work on diesels. Now, this is, you know, regional, of course, but heck, this region I'm talking about is most of the country. I've broken down in this van on the side of the road, stuck on the side of the road, more than any other vehicle I've ever owned. And a couple of times, I've been really in trouble because I couldn't get any help. When I broke down because a turbo hose blew near Great Sand Dune National Park in Colorado, I had to limp all the way to Colorado Springs just to get to a mailbox where I could have a part delivered and I could fix it myself. There was no one who would work on this thing and nobody who had any parts. I had to get the part from Amazon. Had I kept going to Denver, which would have taken me another 4 hours, I could have gone to a shop. But that part that I got on Amazon for like $109 was over $400 at the dealer. And the dealers won't do anything except OEM parts. So when you figure all that, that's why I don't recommend Sprinters. You will have problems with any van. You will have frustrations. Sometimes they may leave you stuck. You may have trouble finding parts. But that huge constellation of grief is really centered on Sprinters. And that's why I say that. Now, that said, if you're a person of means and you're going to go travel the country for a couple of years and you're going to buy a van brand new, outfit it, and then sell it in a few years, heck yeah, go for a Sprinter. I think you're going to have an amazing experience in the thing. I think they're wonderful. If you listen back far enough in the podcast, you remember I said I never ever want to sit in a Sprinter because I'm afraid I'll fall in love with it. And I did. And it broke my heart. Also on top of that, I want to add that my Sprinter was special in a few ways. It was an ambulance. This is a special case. And it had been in an accident that wasn't properly repaired, and I did not pick up on that before I bought it. So my very first repair was to replace the entire radiator because the connecting point between the radiator and the transmission oil cooler, somebody had just bodged up and it was leaking, and the only way to fix it properly was to replace everything. So, are Sprinters junk? No. Are Sprinters expensive? Yes. Are Sprinters problematic? Yes, in my opinion. Even despite Jess having a wonderful experience with hers, and again, they bought it brand new, I'm assuming it's a VS30, and that is the latest, greatest model, and it's new. And there's a whole other aspect that I haven't even mentioned. If you bought a T1N as a Freightliner or a Dodge Sprinter or an NCV3 as a Freightliner, well, and there actually were some VS30 Freightliners, now nobody's going to work on them. Mercedes will not work on a brand that is not named Mercedes, even if it's exactly the same van. I've heard many reports of that. I have to address one other thing that Jess said. She said that, based on my experience, I'm saying that Sprinters are no good. Well, no, it's a little bit more than that. I have done a lot of research on all of these vans in the course of doing the podcast and in the course of looking for a van for myself. I'm not just looking at my one van and saying these are junk. I'm looking at the entire history of all these vans, and I actually do look at the complaints for each of these vans and see how many there are versus how many vans there are. And the reason I say that the Transit, the Ford Transit in North America right now is your best option for a van is that I see the fewest complaints from them, and there are the most of them. They are the most popular van sold in the US. So that tells me folks are having a less hard time with them. And on top of that, they have the most places that you can repair them. But the big point of this, and I'm going long, that seems to be the case all the time now. Don't let anyone tell you your van is junk. Your van is your van. It is you. It is the best van. And never listen to someone poo-pooing a van you have. I'm sure there are people out there who have exactly the same Sprinter I do, and it doesn't feel good to have somebody say all these bad things about them. But all of our circumstances are different. And if you're out there with a Sprinter ambulance from that year and it's working fine, that is awesome, and I keep driving that as long as you can. Drive it till the wheels fall off, because that was my plan. I really hope you don't end up in the situation I do. But if you're out there looking to buy a van, you don't have a van, then it's useful to listen to advice from me and all the other people out there about their experiences and the things they've learned. So thank you, Jess. That was an excellent note. I really appreciate you writing to me. And, ooh, segue. Thank you to Jess for making it so there are no ads on this podcast, because Jess bought me a few gallons of diesel, or actually it just says gallons, so I'm just going to say that from now on. Bought me a few gallons at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's two T's, not three, not one. Because of Jess and the folks who have donated in the past and the folks who donate every month, this podcast has no ads, and we're going to keep it that way for as long as we possibly can. And if you guys would like to contribute to that, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. And you can buy me a gallon or two of whatever you'd like. Coffee, gasoline, I don't know, radiator fluid. It's all good. I need lots of fluids, and I will gladly accept them all. Van life news. Okay, I've got three pieces of news, but we're going to go through them pretty quick. Canada Parks. This is, you could consider this, if you're from the U.S. and, you know, you think Canada's that big white spot at the top of the map, you don't know what's up there. Canada Parks is like the National Park Service for Canada. It's hardly surprising that they have one. And from June 20th to September 2nd, 2025, they're offering free admission and a 25% discount on fees for camping and overnight stays. That's a great deal. This is high season, and that's when they're doing this? I mean, that is awesome. So if the U.S. national parks are all messed up because of the fire at Grand Canyon, RIP Grand Canyon Lodge, that is tragic, or whatever else is going on down here, hey, consider heading up to Canada and checking out some of their parks, because while they don't have as many parks as the U.S. does, they have some pretty nice parks. So, I will have a link in the show notes to look at this deal, but it's at parks.canada.ca. And I wish I had time, because I would love to go up there and take advantage of this. Next on the list, just very quickly, I will occasionally do a search to see, you know, where there are camping bans happening in the U.S. They are usually disguised as homeless legislation or whatever, but the bottom line is that boondocking in the U.S. is getting very, very, very difficult, especially stealth camping. Camping in cities now in many places is flat out illegal. It's sometimes a felony, and while local jurisdictions say, no, we're not going after the camper van, folks, we're after the homeless, whatever, there's a law that exists that a law enforcement person who has a bug up their butt could use against you, and I don't like that. But just a quick search, I found bans being instituted in New York, California, Colorado, Alaska, Idaho, Massachusetts, and North Dakota, and that was not an exhaustive search. So I will keep looking at that issue, but it's not like it was just a few years ago. You can't just roll into Walmart and think, okay, I'm good. You are risking arrest or worse in many places in the U.S. right now, and it's kind of a shame. Also a shame is that ticks. Ticks are on the rise. Now, ticks are the little arachnids that climb up on you and suck your blood, and then, you know, sometimes introduce diseases such as Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Lyme disease, and that increasingly new disease where you have a Lone Star tick on you, and then you're allergic to meat. Allergic to meat. It's very specific and weird, but that is really on the rise. Ticks are in places that they never were before. I never saw a tick as a kid in the woods of New Hampshire, Vermont, or Massachusetts. And I've never, until recently, I'd never seen one in Illinois. I mean, our place here in Illinois is fairly north. I just saw my first tick this year. Yeah, and in ER's report, a whole bunch of new admissions for tick-borne illnesses. So, ticks do respond to DEET. DEET is not bad for you. DEET's got this big, long chemical name, and people are afraid of it. But if you look at the research, it's not bad for you. And Picardin is the other one. Those are the two that actually work. All the other lemon oils and stuff really don't have much evidence to support them. So if you're heading out into the country, basically if foliage is touching you, make sure you're wearing some kind of insect repellent. And you can treat your clothes, too, with permethrins, which is just it's actually a chrysanthemum extract, and that will help, too. And if also have a tick key in your vehicle, and don't let ticks stay on you for very long. After you've gone into tick country, it's really a good idea to have somebody check you for ticks, and if you notice any weird rashes, absolutely seek help, because some of these diseases are serious. I had Lyme disease, and it basically knocked me out for a month. It was pretty rough, and I wonder if I didn't have long-term consequences from that. I mean, there's a whole thing about chronic Lyme that may or may not be a real thing, but my joints, honestly, have never felt the same after I had Lyme disease, although there's some evidence to say that the Cipro I took might have had something to do with that. Anyway, doesn't matter. Don't listen to me. Talk to a doctor. And, yeah, and watch out for ticks. You know, as the country gets warmer, the ticks go up a little bit farther north every year. Tech Talk. If you have a wet spot in your camper, like I do, so you got to drill a hole. That's the part you're not going to like. So if there's a part of your vehicle where you constantly have water, like under a window or on the ceiling or whatever, and I actually learned this from having a house renovated, that if there's a leak inside your house, this is the same thing. If you see like a water spot on your ceiling, or if you have wings on your truck camper like I do, and there's water there, drill a hole. Seriously, you want to get the water out. That's the very first, most important thing. And typically, anything that's been soaked has to be replaced anyway. Now, it's not quite the same if it's a metal part of your van that hasn't started rusting. You'd have to evaluate whether you want to drill a hole there or not. But if it's a soft part, if it's a wooden part that has gotten a little bit soft, you're going to have to replace it. Drill a hole and let the water out. And again, it's true for homes too. If you have a leak in your ceiling, just drill a hole and let the water drip out. That's going to cause less damage than the hole you're making, because that water will just pool up there and spread. So it's just a good bit of advice to remember that if you have a leak in your vehicle and it's pooling somewhere and that's a damaged area, drill a hole, let it drain. That will stop the damage in that area. Then fix the leak, which is the hardest part of the whole thing, and then replace the damaged area. But drill, baby, drill. I am not afraid of drilling holes, and this is one of the cases where I think drilling makes a lot of sense. Product review. For, 2 years now, I've been wearing these Skecher sneakers. No, I am not a skateboarder. It's funny how these things start off as one thing and end up being another one. Skechers are now like the preferred shoe of old guys now, and especially the new ones because they're pop-in. And let me tell you, these things are wonderful for the kind of life you lead when you're traveling, especially in a vehicle. If you haven't tried these, go to a shoe store or whatever and try some on and give it a try. They look a little goofy at first, but you get used to it really quick. And yes, I have a link in the show notes to all the different varieties they have on Amazon, which Zappos, I think, is owned by Amazon. That's how that works. And they have men's and women's. But the concept behind these is that they're sneakers slash shoes that you don't have to tie and you don't have to use your hands to put them on. And that comes in handy an awful lot when you're living in a van. You just step into them, and they snap. Your heel goes in, and then it snaps in like a mold around your heel, and they're secure. I just did all these trips all over these countries that I went to wearing nothing but Skechers, which is probably not advisable, but I was really tight on space, and I didn't have a problem. It was fine. They had enough support for my feet. They were comfortable. And at the end of the day, I could just kick them off. And then, and this is the part that's important, if I needed to get my shoes on in a hurry for some reason, for example, I remember one morning there was a knock on the door at like 6 a.m. I didn't know what it was. So I quickly put on some clothes and then put on my shoes in like 2 seconds because I just stepped into them and went to the door. And oh, yeah, it was the breakfast room service. I had forgotten that I'd ordered. But that type of thing happens all the time in a van. I mean, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, your dog's really got to pee, it's raining out, and you're like, oh, all right, and you don't want to just open the door and let the dog out, so you're going to go out with the dog, and like, okay, hold on, and then you look for your sneakers, and then you put your one foot in, and then you tie it, and then the tongue is bent, you got to do it again, and you know, it takes time. But with these Skecher shoes, you just foot, done, that's it, and you have comfortable, sturdy shoes. They also make boots, and a friend of mine named Matt has tried those. I have not tried them yet, and since he and I seem to have the same wardrobe, weirdly, I will probably end up with a pair of those. But for now, I can only speak to the low shoes, and they're wonderful. I really think you should just have one pair of these. It doesn't have to be all of your shoes. You can still have hiking boots. You can still have flip-flops, whatever. But having a pair of these by the door is just so very convenient that I like have a hard time tying shoes now because it's like, boy, this is a lot of work. So anyway, you wear the shoes you want, but if you're looking for comfortable shoes that go on very quickly, the Skecher pop-ins are really good. And there is a link in the show notes. Tales from the road. So we had a little adventure on Bimini. And backing up a step here, so I took a bunch of people to the Bermuda Triangle as kind of a survive the Bermuda Triangle trip. And, well, I have survived the Bermuda Triangle many, many times, as has anybody just about who has gone on a cruise from southeastern Florida, from either Port Canaveral or Miami or Fort Lauderdale, or the very few that go from West Palm Beach. Yeah, folks, you've been through the Bermuda Triangle, and guess what? You survived. And because the Bermuda Triangle is really just this made-up thing. It's just one of these things that somebody made up and has taken on this life that has been around my entire life. And it's used like as an adjective for other things, you know, like anything. Well, I've got this Bermuda Triangle under my bed where my socks go missing or whatever. Anyway, it's all made up. Charles Berlitz, the language guy, remember Berlitz language courses? Yeah, that was him. He just made it up to sell books. It's kind of amazing that he did such a good job of that, but he did. And all right, one more thing about the Bermuda Triangle. I just did a talk about all 25 most famous ships that went missing in the Bermuda Triangle, and someone recorded it. So it's a very rough production. I mean, I didn't prepare very much for it. I was actually acting as the MC rather than as a presenter, but I did do some research on this and it fit in, so I decided to throw it in. But if you would like to see a 15-minute presentation on the 25 most famous vessels to disappear in the Bermuda Triangle, I'll have a link in the show notes. It's actually YouTube, and you get to see me running around a cruise ship talking about, you know, ships. Anyway, Bimini is in the Bermuda Triangle. Yeah, folks, people live in the Bermuda Triangle, and somehow they don't just disappear. I know, shocking. So we went to Bimini. This is a very small populated island in the Bahamas. Not very small by Bahamas standard, but there aren't that many people that live there. It's basically two islands, and there's a lab there. There's a lab that studies lemon sharks. And since the people with me were kind of sciencey, I thought, well, let's see if we can go there. And I got a hold of the lab and we arranged to go visit. And everything was fine until we started doing the logistics and I realized that I screwed up. We're supposed to take a water ferry from the North Island to the South Island. And I thought it was right at the end of the dock where our ship docked, but it wasn't. It was at a totally different part of the island. We had no way to get there. So our first mission was to find a way to get the water taxi, which didn't have a schedule. It just kind of went back and forth as it felt like it. And I found a taxi guy. He took us down there. That was fine. Some of us took a golf cart. This is a very small place. And we got on the water taxi. And then I realized that where we were going, I probably could have hit with a rock. I'm pretty sure I could have swum across to this other island, but it was across a channel, and it was only $3, so I'm like, okay, fine. So we take the water taxi across. I think it took about 90 seconds, and we get to the other island, which is the island with the lab, and the lab is on the other side of the island, and we have no way to get there other than to walk. Now, I had done some research, and I saw that there was this straight line road from where we were at the taxi stop to the lab. And it was labeled Nature Trail. And I thought, okay, this is good. That's all we need. But all the locals were like, the what? The Nature Trail? You're going to walk? Are you crazy? Which was a little odd, but I'm like, yeah, we're going to walk. So we did. And it was just like it looked on the map. It was just basically a straight line right to the lab. And we start walking down, and then these dogs appear. And they're pit bulls. And they come up to us and were just the friendliest darn dogs you could ever want to meet. They were strays left over from a hurricane. This is a big problem down there, is that hurricanes come and residents leave and leave their pets behind. And this was like a mini pack of stray dogs, but clearly socialized with people. They were lovely until cats came around. And then it was just the classic dogs chasing cats up trees thing. We saw that 3 times. Those cats had better watch out because these dogs want them. So we start walking, and then I am pointing out some of the local foliage because I know some stuff about the area, and we're having a little bit of a nature walk, and then the mosquitoes come, and oh, mosquitoes are pretty bad, and there was one guy in our group who got them worse than others, and I was like, oh, just stay far away from him, and then he will drag all the mosquitoes to him, and the rest of us will be fine, and that strategy worked for me. So I think that was okay. And then we got to this little dock, and there were upside-down jellyfish swimming in there. And they're just what they sound like. They're jellyfish, but they actually live upside down. And they're different than jellyfish that just pulse in the water. These guys will sit on the seabed and feed, and then they'll jump up and, like, swim around to another place. They're pretty cool. And as we're looking at them, and I'm explaining them to folks, and this is an international group of folks. Some of them were from Sweden and Australia and Canada. The dogs jump in the water. This one in particular, he jumps in the water and he's swimming around and he's like sea dog. And it was kind of cool. So the dog gets out and we make our way to the lab and we meet the people there. And it was just delightful. We met 2 young women, one from Italy and one from Australia. And they were basically dedicating their lives to studying lemon sharks and their very unusual life cycle. Lemon sharks give live birth. You know, they're not placental mammals. They don't give live birth in the same way that a mammal does. But basically, a young baby shark wriggles out of the mother and is, you know, in the water pretty much good to go. There's no eggs involved. And that's kind of amazing. And they need the mangroves to breed in and to live in when they're young. And we had this whole big talk about sharks and how Jaws was actually a bad movie in regards to public perception of sharks because it made them all look violent and every single shark attack is all over the news when actually they're much less dangerous than, say, bumblebees or coconuts. And it was so nice meeting these young people who were living in pretty austere conditions. They were basically camping there, studying these sharks, and they were willing to meet with us and show us everything. It was wonderful. If you ever want to go visit, you can arrange that. You just have to search for Shark Lab Bimini and then figure out all the logistics of getting there because it's tricky, and there's more to the story. You'll hear that in a minute. So I knew part of this visit to the lab would be to go see the sharks, and I thought, you know, they've got tanks in the back, and there's baby sharks in there and stuff, and they said, okay, you ready to go see the sharks? And I'm like, yes, let's go. And they went outside. I was like, okay, well, maybe the tanks are around back. And we're following them, and then I noticed we're heading to the ocean, and they don't stop. They walk into the ocean. Now, it was super shallow here. It's actually beautiful. In fact, the picture that is in the show notes is of the area where we were playing with the sharks, basically. We waded into water less than knee-deep, and the lemon sharks came, and they just came out of the mangroves and started swimming around our feet. And these are you see these in aquariums sometimes. These sharks are 3 or 4 feet long when they're big. They're not huge sharks. They don't bite people unless you're an idiot. And it was really cool to have these young scientists talking with us about their passion for these animals and having them swimming around our feet in this turquoise blue water on a bright sunny day, surrounded by mangroves. And it was just one of these really nice memories that I will carry with me forever. That was because we didn't do the normal thing. We didn't do a ship's excursion. We didn't, you know, find the bar to hang out in or any of that. We did the hard thing. I found this place that was interesting, but it was going to be a lot of work to get there, and about half of us actually went through with it and got there. And those half, if any of you happen to listen to this podcast, you are my peeps. You folks were not going to be stopped. We were going to go see those sharks, and it was a great, great experience. However, trying to get back was a little bit of an issue. Obviously, we're on a big ship. We have to get back in a certain time. The folks called a taxi for us. Taxi said they'd be there in 15 minutes. We were reminded that island time is a little bit different than regular time, and that 15 minutes turned into 30. She called back, and they said that they were not feeling like coming, so that was it. And we were like, okay, so we have to walk back, which we can do, but at this point, a lot of the folks were terrified of the mosquitoes and didn't walk back. And these two women did something extraordinary, and absolutely do not expect this if you happen to go visit them, because this was above and beyond. We had given them a nice donation, and that may have sparked this behavior. But she said, well, we don't really have any vehicles except, well, let me show you. and one of them says, you get the Ford, I'll get the Kubota. And one of them gets this Kubota kind of UTV kind of a vehicle. It was a big golf cart, basically, and we load some people in there, and the other one comes out from behind with this battered F-150 from like 1996 or something. And she said, this truck's seen a lot, but it still runs, and it's not registered or anything, but we'll take you. And we're like, sure. So we piled into this beat-up Ford where there's just springs for seats, and as soon as we got into it, water started pouring out of the ceiling. I don't know exactly what was going on there, but apparently there was a leak, but if there wasn't weight in it, the water just pooled up, and then when there was weight, it all just dumped. Anyway, we did not care. These two folks were so nice to us, and they drove us all the way to the water taxi. We got on the water taxi, back to the North Island, had a nice lunch. I called the same taxi driver who picked us up, and we made it back to the ship in time. It was a wonderful day. It's a day I will cherish. And that's what can happen if you're willing to take things into your own hands, take some risks, endure some discomfort. And you can see things like that rather than just go hang around at another Bahamanian bar, which I have done plenty for a lifetime. place to visit. Many of you have been to Key West, and we have talked about how hard it is to do van life there. So if you're going to go to Key West, be sure you have a plan for how you're going to spend the night. And the best way is to find a campground space, which is not easy. Key West is extremely anti-van life, extremely. And if you get trapped down there, your problem is you really don't have anywhere to go. All you can do is kind of drive all the way back up to Miami or Homestead or Florida City, somewhere up there, and hope for the best. And that's hours away. But should you find yourself in Key West, there's a place that not enough people go to. And I'm not talking about the Hemingway House or Sloppy Joe's or the Audubon House or the Butterfly House or the treasure museums or any of that stuff. This is going to also take effort. It's the Fort East Morello Museum. This is a Civil War fort that was never quite finished, but was built during the Civil War when Key West was a Union city during the Civil War. So we had a Union city south of Florida, which was a Confederate state, but there was no road and no bridge to get there. So it was pretty well protected with a couple of frigates. And the fort itself is interesting because it's a fort, but it's now a museum of kind of like Key West life, and there's all kinds of different stuff in there. But one of the things in there is pretty famous. And rumor has it that if you have ever seen the movies Chucky or Annabelle, what is in there is the inspiration for those movies. And it is called Robert the Doll. I will have a link in the show notes. The deal with Robert the Doll is he's this rather large doll, larger than a doll you'd kind of like have on your bed, wearing a sailor suit. And he has this unusual look on his face. And in his lap, he has kind of a very, very old stuffed lion. And apparently, Robert does not like rude people. And so the legend is that if you take his picture without permission, he will curse you. And then you're in trouble. And of course, this is true. You remember I had surgery, okay? So I have to be careful how I walk. And I have been doing really, really well. I haven't twisted my ankle much until I walked in front of Robert the Doll and took his picture. Within a minute, I twisted my ankle worse than I have since the entire surgery thing happened, and I was like, okay, I have just undone my surgery. Now, fortunately, I have healed enough that I was able to recover from that, and I don't think I did any permanent damage. But nothing like that had happened until I walked in front of Robert the Doll. And then after that, everyone in our group started assigning every bad thing to Robert the Doll. Like, oh, my Diet Coke is flat, Robert the Doll. Or my flight's delayed, Robert the Doll, etc., etc., etc. You can see how this works. But there's hope. Should you visit Robert the Doll and get cursed, you can kind of ask for the curse to be lifted by sending Robert a letter of apology saying, I'm sorry, Robert. I should have asked permission. Please forgive me and please lift the curse. And quite a few of these letters were on display in the museum. The museum is cool. The Robert the Doll is actually pretty cool. And while I'm not much for superstition, and I'm pretty sure the reason I twisted my ankle in front of Robert the Doll was actually the uneven brickwork or slate work that's in front of his case, while I'm taking his picture, I'm pretty sure that was actually what happened. It's an interesting coincidence, and it makes for a good story. So, next time you're in Key West, if you don't want to see all the normal touristy stuff, hop in a cab or rent a bike and head out to East Fort Morello Museum and visit Robert the Doll, but be sure to be polite. Also, they have an excellent gift shop, and you can buy a Robert the Doll of your own so he can kind of watch over you to make sure you're behaving. Resource recommendation. Hey, since we're talking about Canada's parks, why don't I make it easy for you? They have an app. It's called the Parks Canada app, and it's really well done. This is kind of how an app should be done. It has a map of all the places in the park system. It has information on how to do reservations, and it also has audio tours of places in the parks. Like, and so you basically can go in the app and figure out where you are and see if there's an audio tour. For example, at Fundy National Park, which has nothing to do with fundamentalists and everything to do with the Bay of Fundy, They have an audio tour of Elizabeth's pollinator garden, and you can hear the tour as you're walking around the beautiful garden. Quebec has a whole bunch of these. You can have an audio tour of Saint-Louis Forts and Chateau National Historic Site. In Ontario, you can get an audio tour of Thousand Islands National Park, Manitoba, the Forks National Historic Site, Saskatchewan even, but Choche National Historic Site, and so on and so forth. And heck, even the SS Klondike has its own tour. That's cool. That's just a nice little thing they've added into the app, which is now it's not only informational, it's also fun. And because, you know, Canada, big parks, you may be without Wi-Fi, they've designed the app to work without Wi-Fi. They also have driving tours and walking tours, and you can favorite stuff. Anyway, for a national park app, I think this sets the standard for this is how apps should be. And if you're going to be traveling through Canada, you might as well get the app. It's for iPhone and Google Play. I'll have a link in the show notes, but it's at parks.canada.ca, just like you expected. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 265. For those of you who noticed that episode 264 was a bit too quiet, I did re-upload the file. Volume should be better now. I hope to never make that mistake again. Thank you for telling me about it. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of John Muir, who said, "Of all the paths you take in life, make sure a few are dirt."